That's true. But it is, right. You're right. They shouldn't be mutually exclusive.
We always use that as a program.
Right.
If shop is around this or not.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, the events are opposite in the sense that the Berlin Wall was the beginning of the end for communism,
right.
And Kristallnacht was the beginning of the end for Jews in Europe.
Right.
But they're both sort of these events, which are beginning of the end. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, but it was the beginning of the end of a joyous thing. It was the beginning of the end of communism.
Which is wonderful.
Eastern Europe.
Which is why I noted, because, communism was very, 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 very bad for the individual, you know, to say the least. And it's really, my father always says he still can't believe that there's no Soviet Union, because people, you know, expected the Soviet Union to go on forever.
It happened overnight.
Yeah.
And the whole Eastern Bloc collapsed.
And who would have thought that could have happened without bloodshed, right?
Yeah.
It's one of the great miracles of history, and I called, my best friend lives in Germany, I called him today to see what was going on, and it's a huge deal here, but it's a very big deal over there, and in a different way.
Is he German?
He's from Munich. He's German-American. His father's American, and his mother's German. And, you know, the Americans maintained this gigantic Air Force base in Ramstein, Germany, which is much smaller now than it used to be. But during the times of the draft, his father was sent over there. So you have a lot of these couples, American servicemen marrying German women. So that's how...
It's also a very big Jewish community in Munich.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah, actually, Rabbi Longinus has been here a bunch of times.
I've met him.
Yeah. What do you mean by big?
It's pretty, by European standards, it's pretty big.
It's been there forever. Right. There was a DP camp where the concentration camp was.
Right, Dachau was just outside the city. My grandfather spent some time in that DP camp.
And I'll tell you a funny thing. This is a small world story. I'll make it fast.
Yeah, sure.
I was in Bangkok, and I was sitting around the pool, and I was sitting next to a guy, and we started talking, and he had a heavy accent, and he said he went to Brandeis University. And I'm thinking, could he be Jewish? Why would somebody from Germany go to Brandeis? And then some guy came over to talk to him, and when he left, he said, did you recognize what we're saying? I said, I don't speak German. He said, we weren't speaking German, we were speaking Yiddish. So we were both thinking. And he said that he was from that community, and that what happened with his parents, well, they were DPs. They got married, and they couldn't get visas. And then they started having a business and making it. I think that's where the community came from. And it's quite, these people are quite substantial.
Yeah.
10 years later, when the United States sent them visas in 1955, they said, we've been disrupted twice in our lifetime.
How do you pick yourself up again,
learn another language and another community and another business?
I didn't tell you the small world story, but I said, we went to Brandeis, did you know this daughter of a friend of mine? And he said, no, but let me ask my friend. And then that night, his friend came over and he said, yeah, I took her out when I go to the United States and hit KJ and somebody
introduced
her. That's his small world.
That's funny.
So, what's your birthday?
What?
You said the election.
Oh, yeah, so November 5th is my birthday. The Yankees won just in time for my birthday. Just in time for my birthday. It's really the best possible present I could imagine getting. But thank you. Yeah, it was like...
Yeah, I mentioned last year on election day.
A better year for the Democrats than this year was.
Yeah.
It's funny, as a political wind shift, but I was thinking about that too. I wanted to talk this week. Last week we've discussed Abraham and discussed some of his positive legacies. And I wanted to bring up a topic that might be somewhat uncomfortable, but I think is very, very important, not just for understanding the issue which we're going to discuss today, but in terms of one's general approach to Tanakh, which is the idea that, and again, you know, the first thing I want to do is get everybody's views on this, whether or not our forefathers, our matriarchs, our patriarchs, the great biblical heroes, whether or not we can criticize them. So before we discuss this particular instance, I want to talk about an episode that happened in Abraham and Sarah's life, which I think is a very important legacy for us. And it happens to be the one where Hagar, not where Hagar is sent away, but when Hagar runs away of her own volition. There are two episodes with Hagar. I just want to make that clear. How do we look at Avram and Sarah's behavior in that instance? So we're going to read all the psukim together. But before we discuss this specific case, I just wanted to go around and get a sense of, you know, there are different outlooks on this issue, where people fall out in terms of whether or not it's legitimate to criticize biblical figures. So some people might be very uncomfortable with that here. Some people might be very open to that. So I just wanted to present that as a small discussion piece before we begin. So does anybody have any a strong feeling on it? Yeah, Arthur.
My feeling is that the writer was very smart in showing that these people who we put up as heroes or the things were human beings with human qualities. Mm-hmm. They were not divine. We've known the result of when you take a human being and you make a religion out of him, you make him God. Mm-hmm. Right. And you know, this predates this thing. The thing that disturbed me more in Abram's life, mm-hmm. than this, is when he pimped his wife. Yeah. I mean, that was worse than this thing here, because this was very common with right. handmaids and second wives. But that the fact that he put her off as his sister,
right?
I mean, it was like a pimp.
Right, and it's interesting because
I mean, really,
their Chazal are critical of Avram for that. So that's one perspective. Arthur is saying is that, you know, if I just reformulate it, but I think that this is pretty faithful to Arthur's version, which is that these great figures in Tanakh are only meaningful for us if they can be fallible as well. In other words, if they're perfect, so then all of their triumphs and their successes aren't meaningful either, because there was no other possible outcome. But if really they are fallible and they can make mistakes, and sometimes they do, that makes all of their triumphs that much more impressive. And we can learn from both their successes and their failures. Marilyn.
Well, from the beginning, the mm-hmm. whole tenor is we have choices.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, from Bereshit, you know, the very beginning of Bereshit, you know, we have choices, and we have choices. It's just tacit that either they're wise or not wise. So,
and as far as
the basis of our whole.
So you say there's no way to understand any of the characters that we meet in Tanakh without saying that, yes, sure, they can do good things, but they could also make the wrong decisions.
Yes,
so for you, this is a very intuitive concept.
To me, that's the whole learning from the very outset.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else want to weigh in?
I just want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Where did Sarah, whatever
right.
come from? I mean, they tell you about the other brothers, but I was looking last week, all of a sudden he married her, but who was she? Where did she come from?
Right, okay, so it's a good question. According to, according to the Midrashic tradition, but it also has support in the text, is that Avram, you know, had a brother named Haran,
right.
And Haran had three children.
Yeah, but one of them...
One of them is Lot, right? We know that, and then Haran dies and Avram adopts Lot. But it also says that there was Milcah and Yiscah. So, Milcah, we know, marries Nahor.
Right.
And according to the Medrash, Yiscah, the woman who we're told is Yiscah, is Sarah. Again, the textual support for this, even though that sounds like a wacky idea, if it was Sarah, why didn't the Torah just say Sarah? Is because the story that Arthur was referring to just a second ago, on a number of occasions, Abraham tells Sarah to say, "You're my sister," right? And then a number of times in the text it says, "Yes, we share a relationship on our father's side," meaning Sarah,
she was his cousin.
Niece, right? Right. That
rose up.
So it's and in Lechacha, so that in other words, Abraham's brother is Haran.
Oh, that's his
daughter. Right, and so Haran has
loaded. But Milcah is made a big deal out of when they give the genealogy.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But they don't mention.
Right, so we know that what is pshat in the psukim is that they were relatives on their father's side. How exactly that relation worked out is a midrashic explanation. But just in terms of returning to the question, so everybody here feels comfortable with the idea that we can be critical at times of figures in
Tanakh. As long as you can learn from them.
As long as you can learn from them.
They always bring out all the frailties of David HaMelech.
Sure. Yes, Ruth.
You know, in the past couple of years, when reading, when they talk about this episode, mm-hmm. the Sarah, they compare, I forgot the code is called,
the Hammurabi?
And that it fits in with that, what, you know, Sarah did, was, you know, goes along with that. So that I've been reading, like, when commentaries, only about the past 2 years.
Oh, okay, so that there's some comparative legal issue here.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to bring that up as a discussion piece because, for two reasons. First of all, people should know that, you know, outside of our sector of the Orthodox world, there are many sections of the Orthodox world, especially in recent times, like the last 50 years, where the approach they take is just the opposite. So you're going to hear, if you ever have a dialogue about religious personalities, biblical personalities, with Orthodox people of a different camp, so the approach that they take is, and it's just important to be aware of this for purposes of dialogue, and you know, it's always important to go into conversations aware of the assumptions of other people, that really biblical characters don't make mistakes. And they tend to interpret events in the Bible, which we might have one perspective on, okay, in a different kind of way. And I say this because I think that it's the strong majority within our tradition. We're going to see Rishonim, but even going well before that, in terms of Chazal, and we've spoken about a number of examples on occasion here, that are highly critical, though very reverent, of our biblical figures. And I don't think that there's, again, you know, what you might hear from people who don't subscribe to this idea that our biblical figures can make mistakes. They might tell you, but how can you say that? It's Abraham Avinu, or it's Moshe Rabbeinu. But really, I think our approach is always that both things can be true, and both things are true. That what makes these people such great role models is that they were humans like the rest of us, but that they, through hard work, the blood, sweat, and tears of working on one's personality, they were able to achieve a lot, but that doesn't make them perfect. And again, as the expression of Chazal goes, Lo nishna ha-Torah le-malachei ha-shares. The Torah was not meant to be given to the ministering angels of heaven. The whole point, I think this is what Marilyn was alluding to, is that the Torah was given to man, and even though there are great men and great women, they can sometimes make mistakes. So it's with that that I wanted to introduce a passage from Bereishit. It's a very difficult passage. Yeah.
I just want to say, last night at the book club, Rabbi Mintz mentioned that there are books that were printed about the famous rabbis of our generation and the past generation that are no longer in print, that you cannot get your hands on because they had information in them that was not always favorable.
Right.
And these books have disappeared off the face of the earth.
Right. So that's very important. So it's part of a broader ideology, I would say, that, you know, we have to consciously project that our great leaders are perfect. And that we're in no position to ever question what they do. And
the conservative movement says, you know, that you need myths, and therefore they call a lot of this.
Right, but we don't want to say either. We really want to strike a path in the middle where we say everything that we see is true, but there can be, right, we certainly believe that about the Torah, but there are things, most of the things, the overwhelming majority of things are positive legacies, but then there are also some things that we can and should be critical of. And the reason that this is so important, I'm glad that Gladys brought up this point, is because this is part of a broader contemporary swing towards portraying, you know, rabbis or rabbinic figures or, you know, biblical figures as perfect. And again, you know, we don't have to, I think a central pillar of our community is that we reject oversimplifying life. It doesn't all have to be good or bad or black and white. It can be, right, nuanced and somewhere in the middle, and we can have these great figures, these truly great tzaddikim and tzadkaniyot, who we look to for inspiration and guidance, who we can also be critical of. And we can maintain both of those poles without saying, as Marilyn was alluding to, what some other people would say, which is that these stories are all just made up, that we can take them very seriously and take these characters you know, extremely seriously and treat them with great reverence, but without deifying them. There has to be a middle ground. And that middle ground is, I think, one of the hallmarks of our community. And it becomes very, very important for the way that we read Tanakh.
Is
Is that the operating principle of YU today?
Of YU?
Yes.
I can't speak for all of YU, but definitely the people that I've been exposed to.
Okay, that's right.
Right. Definitely the people that I've been exposed to. And again, it's not even that anybody who reads Gemara or Midrash or Rishonim sees that it's all over the place, you know, criticism, healthy criticism. And that's a central part of our tradition. Is that there's a difference between even the greatest human being and God. Yeah, Marilyn.
No, sorry. The first time I really experienced this very dramatically was with Elie Wiesel.
Okay.
And I almost felt like the first time I ever heard him speak, I almost felt like standing up and sweating. Because he's so... most of his speeches henceforth, you know, after that I heard, is, his questioning, mm-hmm. which is, can be very critical.
Right.
We need to question. So maybe it isn't so much criticism per se. It's first before that. It's questioning. You know, how could this be?
So again, it's a type of reverence. We would have reverence, but we also don't shut off our minds and shut off our brains and stop asking, you know, what exactly happened here, Ruth.
Oh, well, in the rough book on Abraham, mm-hmm. near the end of it, he talks about how we don't know very little of some of the people here, like Sarah at the beginning, mm-hmm. and how even, you know, the ones further on, the humility, and that, but even in Talmud, the Talmud, you only get to know the name because it's the minority view or something.
Right.
He speaks about it in a beautiful section.
Okay, I'll take a look at it. I've been holding off reading the book until after the semester, because I don't want to cheat. Sometimes the Rav gives you all these beautiful ideas. I want to work through the primary text. Okay, so I think that's a very important philosophical point, and especially because it's so much under attack in the contemporary day and age. So I'm glad that, you know, we have a working consensus going into this passage, about which we're going to see a great controversy. So this is from Parshat Lech Lecha, Genesis chapter 16. And the story will be, I guess, familiar to most of us, but I just want to read every pasuk carefully, as carefully as we can, because even though the story is familiar, I think that oftentimes the story is grossly misunderstood or misrepresented. V'sarai eshet Avram, lo yalda lo, v'la shibcha mitzrit u'shma Hagar. So Sarai was the wife of Avram, and she didn't have any children. And she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. Vatomer Sarai el Avram. Therefore Sarai goes and says to Avram, her husband, Hinena atzarani Adonai miladet, Hashem has prevented me from having children. Bo na el shivchati, have sexual relations with my maidservant. Ulai ibane mimena. Perhaps I will be able to be bone, right, to build from her. So, I want to stop here for a second before we continue with the pasuk and the passage. What is Sarah's plan? What is the plan?
It sounds almost like she expects that the child that Hagar was going to bear is really going to be born for her and Avram.
Beautiful, Susan. Exactly. In other words, surrogate. That's the modern-day equivalent to surrogate. Sarah is going to... The plan is that Sarah will really be the... Hagar is going to be the surrogate, but Sarah will be Ulai Ibn. She's going to be the mother. That, right? You would imagine at this point that what's the plan roughly? The plan is roughly that Hagar will conceive the child, will harbor the child and deliver the child, probably nurse the child, and then at some point give the child over to Sarah. That's the plan. So Sarah is suggesting to Avram, have relations with my Shivcha, but there's going to be, and God willing, there will be a child, and I will really be, for all intents and purposes, after a certain point, the mother of that child. That's what it sounds like. Again, that point isn't sufficiently appreciated. Usually the way that this is explained is that, okay, you know, she gave Hagar over to Avram so that Avram could have a child. But that's not what Sarah is saying, right? Sarah seems to be saying that she is going to be ethically, eventually, the influence on this child, that Hagar is a surrogate. Okay, and what happens? Vayishma Avram l'kol Sarai. So Avram listens to Sarai. So what does that mean? How would you interpret those four words? Vayishma Avram l'kol Sarai. Exactly. He did what she told him to do. Except the next pasuk doesn't sound that way. The next pasuk says, "Batikach Sarai eshet Avram et Hagar hamitzrit shivchata." So Sarai, the wife of Avram, took Hagar. Okay, she takes the initiative. Sarah does. Miketz Esther Shanim al Shevet Avram be'eretz Canaan, and this was all happening 10 years after Avram first got to the land of Canaan. Vatitein otali Avram isha, and she gave Hagar over to Avram isha, means ish shala, her husband, lo liisha, as a wife. So what is this pasuk saying now? Again, if Vayishma Avram l'kol Sarai in the previous pasuk meant that it already happened, what's this pasuk telling us? Apparently, Avram wasn't in. Vayishma Avram l'kol Sarai apparently means he listened, but he wasn't ready to take action. Right? That there's something distasteful to Avram, or something that he's not quite comfortable with. Maybe he doesn't want to hurt his wife. And so he waits for Sarah to take the initiative, and for Sarah to literally not just conceive of the plan, but to execute it as well. Secondly, there's a very important one word in the pasuk. When we say that Hagar was given over to Abraham, okay, for the purpose of having this child, what was her status?
Oh, she becomes the wife.
Exactly. You would have, the way that this story is normally presented is people say, oh, she was like a concubine, like what we call in Tanakh a pilegesh. But the pasuk says explicitly that Sarah vatitein otali Avram isha lo liisha. Hagar is now married to Avram. Okay? So she could have given him over. She could have given her over. Sarah could have given over Hagar, that is, as a pilegesh. But no, she gives Hagar status. We're going to have to deal with this. Hagar is made the wife of Avram.
Now, what in that time, how was that accomplished? Just because she said...
It's not clear. Very, very good question. We don't know exactly what the procedure would have been. Obviously, it wasn't the same thing as it was after the Torah was given, and the Rambam does discuss that in his Laws of Marriage. We don't know exactly what the procedure is. What we do know is that it is a question of status. That a pilegesh was primarily a sexual object. That the pilegesh is a conduit for perhaps having more children, or as a sort of sexual object in that society. And isha is really a wife on some level, and of course not in the 2009 sense, but on some level a partner, and who has the rights and privileges that are associated with being not just a pilegesh but a wife.
When
yes.
They say how God despised Sarah.
Okay.
She despised her because she put her in that servitude position.
Okay, so we're going to have to see. Again, that term despising, you know, as far... Let's take a look at the text, because despising would be, I think, at least for me, too strong a term.
Yeah.
Okay? So now we know that there is some kind of a marriage.
Why is there a dagesh in the first isha?
Oh, because that means ish shala. That's a mafike, and grammatically what that means, the Avram isha, the Avram ish shala, Avram the husband of Sarah. So she gives over Hagar to Avram, her husband, as a wife. Okay, it's a little confusing. Vayavo el Hagar, Avram has relations with Hagar, Vatahar, and Hagar conceives, Vatera ki harata, Hagar sees that she has become pregnant, Vatekal givirta be'eneha. Again, Vatekal givirta be'eneha. Her mistress became demeaned in her eyes. Now, what we do not know is whether or not she acted on this, or how exactly she acted on this. What we do have clear evidence of is that was a change in attitude. That Hagar's attitude vis-a-vis her mistress, Sarah, had changed. Vatekal givirta be'eneha. She no longer looks at her exactly the same way. Her mistress has become demeaned in her eyes. What's that? Givirta means givera shela, her mistress.
I'm just looking at that dagesha.
Oh, right. So gveret shalah. The mapik hay, whenever there's a dagesha in the hay, that means shalah. So gveret shalah. Okay? Vatomer Sarai el Avram. So Sarai then turns to Avram and says, Chamasi alecha. My wrath is directed at you. Anochi natati shivchati b'chekecha. I gave you my shivcha. Vatera ki harata. And then my shivcha realized that she had conceived. Va'ikal be'eneha. And now I have become demeaned in her eyes. Yishpot Adonai b'ni u'b'enecha. The Lord should judge between you and I. Sarah is furious with Avram. But let me present this question. What did Avram do? Did Avram do anything wrong?
He did what he was told to do.
Whose idea was this?
Maybe it was his idea that she become the wife.
Right. You know, one could say that, but it doesn't seem like it, because Avram never says a word. Avram never opens his mouth. Avram never does anything. In fact, it almost seems like the opposite, that Avram won't do anything. It's Sarah's idea to begin with. But it would have been totally natural for a man of that generation in time to take on a second wife or a Pilegesh. And it's a shock that Avram hasn't done that already. Apparently Avram is very loyal to Sarah. He waits for Sarah to suggest the idea. And even then he won't act on it. And then it seems to be Sarah again, Batiteno Tali Avram Isha Loli Isha. So again, it could be right, but the simple, you might be right. The text that we have seems to suggest that itself was Sarah's idea. And we're going to see the Ramban deals with that question. Well, it's very good. That's a very, very good suggestion.
He seems to have been a very loyal husband, especially for that day and age. I mean, this was 90 years of age. I mean, and
we know how badly he wanted a son.
He wanted a son, and she seemed to have had a fertility problem.
Okay.
Well, I mean, really.
Yeah, and
she was lucky.
She doesn't.
Never became
she doesn't.
From the relationship she evidently had. When
right.
He gave it to the king of wherever the
well, right. Well, there, right. So there, the Torah says that, you know, miraculously she was saved. But right, yes. she's not denying that. Right, she's barren. Hine natzarani Adonai miladet. So she's not denying that. So, did anybody here feel that there was any justification for Sarah being so furious with Avram?
Yes, it was emotional. She was also furious with Yaakov.
Justify it? Right.
No, she wasn't furious. But
so you're saying, you know... Right.
It became very emotional.
Right.
It turned out to be the way she wanted it to be.
Right. So it would appear that Avram hasn't done anything wrong. It would appear.
But Avram also didn't do anything right. He allowed... Hagar to continue with her attitude.
Okay. So we're very good. So what Gladys is saying is, what Gladys is pointing to, and I'm glad you're defending Sarah, because I really think that this is a good point. Sarah is saying, Hagar is looking at me differently. Now, we don't know how that translated itself into action. How did that manifest itself? We don't know. We're just saying there was a change in attitude.
Probably taunted him. Taunted her.
Maybe. Could be.
Look, I can have a child, I can have your husband's child, and you could.
Right, right.
I don't know what the conversation is.
Right. We don't know. We can speculate. And what it seems to be is that Sarah, right, it seems to be that Sarah wanted Avram to say something.
Right.
Now, here's the issue. Avram's kind of stuck in between a rock and a hard place, isn't he? Because now Avram is married to not only Sarah, but to Hagar as well. So, right, so Avram, you can appreciate, doesn't really want to get involved. Right, he has a problem of conflicting loyalties. But anyway, Sarah is furious with him. She knows just that Chazal do comment on this pasuk that Sarah was in the wrong. There was nothing that Avram
really?
Did. Yeah. But okay, you know, we can, it's very, very important just to debate all the ideas, put everything on the table. Okay, so let's take a look at Avram's reaction. Vayomer Avram el Sarai. Now, I would have expected, or maybe if it was me, I would have said, what do you want from me? What am I doing? Right, I'm just following orders. Vayomer Avram el Sarai. Hine shivchatech biyadech. Your maidservant is in your hands, in your dominion. Asi la hatov be'inayich. Do whatever you wish with her, do whatever you want to her. How is Avram referring to Hagar?
Well,
in this pasuk.
As the shivcha.
As a shivcha. He doesn't address her by name. Secondly, he doesn't address her as my wife.
Right.
It's almost like Avram is now taking sides. Right? He's saying, okay, she's still your shivcha. Do whatever it is you want with her. So Avram doesn't stick up at all for Hagar. He doesn't say, okay, there's a civil way to settle this. He doesn't say, look, you know, this is sort of an occupational hazard. We kind of knew this would probably happen once we went down this choice and this was your idea. So let's not make it any worse than it is. Avram green lights, and he says, Hinei shibchateich biyadeich, asila hatov b'inayich, and what's the result? Vate'aneha Sarai. Sarai oppressed her. Sarai caused her to suffer.
Now, how was a servant, because they use the word servant, not slave.
Right.
In our parlance, a servant is somebody who's a salaried position, where a slave is free.
Right.
So where did she come from? How was she a servant? Did she have... Was she owned, or was she an employee? What was
right.
that? What did it mean?
Right. So I think it's closer to being owned. We don't know. I mean, the beginning of this chapter is where Hagar is introduced to us. We don't know where exactly she came from. Now, Chazal, are you going to? What does the Midrash say? Okay, Gladys.
That she was brought back from Egypt.
Very good.
And she was the daughter
and she was
of the king of Egypt, and that's why, in the end, we were enslaved in Egypt for 210 years for what we did.
So we'll have to take a look. Right. So that she's closer to being a slave. Now, the pasuk says Vatana Sarai caused Hagar to suffer. Vatibrach mipaneha. And so Hagar flees. Okay? Then, we don't have to read the rest of it inside, it's not so crucial. I just want to summarize that the Malach then appears to Hagar and says, okay, you have to go back to your Gveret, Shuvi al Gvirtech, this is in verse 9, Vihitani tachat yadeha, and submit to her suffering, but the good news is that you're going to have a son who's going to turn into the father of a very, very, very great nation. And you're going to call that son Yishmael. This is in verse 11. Why? Ki shama Hashem el onyech. Because Hashem has heard your suffering, your oppression. So, one way to interpret ki shama Hashem el onyech, it would seem, is that this is validation. That Hashem, in a way, sees that Hagar has been wronged. That the treatment that Hagar received was not deserved. Ki shama Hashem el anyich, Hashem is rewarding you with a son who will become father of a very numerous nation because he's seen that you were subjected to suffering.
Okay. But at the same time, it goes on to say he'll be hostile to everybody. He's going to be a horrible person.
Well, that is.
I mean, that's not exactly the kind of news you want to hear.
That is an excellent.
Grow up to be horrible.
That is an excellent point. So, what I do want to stress is that not everybody reads verse 12 in that fashion. In fact. We'll just read it inside now because the issue has now come up. V'hu yihyeh para Adam, okay? This son will be a para Adam. We know Adam means a human. We don't know what para means. Some people interpret this to be, as this translation does, a wild donkey. But not everybody does. Some people say just a merchant of a man. Yadova kol v'yad kol bo. His hand will be outstretched to everything and everybody's hand will be outstretched to him. Which could simply be interpreted to mean that he'll be heavily engaged in commerce. V'alpanei kol echav yishkon, right, and that he'll dwell near his brothers. Okay? In which case, you don't have any of the problems of this being... The Ravenel, for example, takes this view. He says exactly what Gladys said. If this is all supposed to be a comfort to Sarah, how does it make any sense at all that she'll have all this negative information given about her future son? Seems very strange. How is this going to encourage her to go back to Avram and Sarah? It's not. So he interprets that verse very differently. So this translation, in a lot of ways, is good. Here, they're a little too one-sided for my liking, but
But then if she's a slave, she has to go. I mean, it's nice that she's being encouraged to go back.
Right.
She has no choice.
Well, she could always run away. She could say, I'm saving my life.
In the desert and run away.
Well, she'll go back home. You know, so maybe she has to...
Maybe her father wouldn't take her back home?
Well, or
he was the one that effectively sold her into slavery.
Well, right. We just know very little. We know very little about her origins.
Okay.
So we have Sarah, right, oppressing Hagar. That's what happened. And so this is what we're left with. This is the biblical text. And now comes the conversation that we had at the beginning, which is, well, how do we react to that? This is ethically challenging, or it should be, right? That, well, this is obviously a very complex family situation. But how do we understand the behavior of all three characters, Hagar, Sarah, and Abram? So I want to present three views. And I think that this is just from a methodology standpoint, a very important example of where and how and when Chazal and the Baalei HaMesorah took very different views. And it's important for us to be aware of all of that.
Can I ask you one question? At the time that these views were being written, the Arabs were not hostile the way they are today to the Jewish.
Arabs, I wouldn't use the term, do you mean Muslims in general?
Well,
because two of these writers, we're going to see the Ramban and the Abravanel, were living in Muslim lands. The only thing is that the Ramban was really, when he lived in Spain, he lived in Christian Spain.
Right.
So, you know, what his perception of Muslims wasn't, it'd be hard to determine. The Abravanel was, expelled from Spain, but again, that was Christian Spain, so he was a number of centuries after, and the Radak is writing from southeast France, again, which is Christian dominated, so,
the Jews had more problems with the Christians.
Well, it really depends on what historical period you're dealing with. The Muslims, but they weren't directly, none of these three figures were really living under Muslim control. It depends whether you're talking about the Moorish period or the Almohades, as Bernard Lewis has written, he's a great historian of Islam from Princeton University, so, the way that he portrays it, and his books are the ones that I've seen on the topic, that there has been, just as there is today, a struggle between forces within the Islamic world, and clearly the upper hand has shifted to the extreme, to the extremists, the fundamentalists, and unfortunately become very violent. That is actually a centuries-old conflict, internal conflict.
But during all the occupations of the land of Israel, there was such a tremendous exchange of populations that you can't really say who is who.
Right. So I want to avoid. I want to avoid any. 100%. So I don't want to take the historical perspective just to see the text. Let's take a look at how the Ramban understands the passage that we find. Ratzta shetiyeh gam Hagar ishto. Sarah decided that Hagar should not only be a concubine for Avram, but his wife. Ulekach amar lo leisha, shelo tihyeh kipilegesh, rak isha nisu'alo. That it was Sarah's wish that Hagar not be a concubine for Avram, but it was specifically her idea that Abraham should marry Hagar. Remarkable that Sarah herself, as the Pasuk seems to say, is the driving force behind not just the relationship between Abraham and Sarah, but a marital relationship. So there, that is, the issue that you raised. So that's the Ramban. V'cholza musar Sarah v'hakavod shehino tetnoheget bevala. This is a compliment, a great compliment for Sarah, that she was willing to take this remarkable action of self-sacrifice. Again, it's bad for her on a certain level. Now she's going to have a co-wife, right? She could have given over Hagar just as a pilegesh, but Sarah says, you know what? It's not the kavod that I have to be knowing my husband. It's not befitting a man of his dignity and his honor to take a concubine. The only justification that is really fitting the kavod of my husband is for him to take another wife. So that's a remarkable statement in Sarah's favor, that Sarah was willing to sacrifice what would have been good for her for the kavod, for the dignity and the honor of Abraham. So the Ramban is speaking out very, very, in a very laudatory fashion to Sarah. However, Vata'aneha Sarai Vatigrachmi Paneha. This became a very, very famous Ramban. At'a imenu bi'inui hazeh. Sarah imenu sinned. Chat'a imenu bi'inui hazeh. What Sarah did was a sin through oppressing Hagar. But not only that, says the Ramban. V'gam Abraham v'hanicho la'asot kein. Anybody pick up on what the Ramban is saying?
That he let her.
Abraham is equally culpable because he allowed this, he enabled this to happen. Again, what did Abraham say to Sarah? Hinei shivchateich v'yadeich asila hatov v'naech. Abraham is guilty for not defending the woman who was then his wife. Right? Now Hagar is his wife also. So Sarah is guilty, and Abram is guilty as well. And not only that, says the Ramban, but thirdly, Vishama Hashem el Aniyah. Hashem heard her suffering, as the Pasuk says, Ki Shama Hashem el Aniyah. Vinatan la ben sheyehe pera adam. And the Ramban says, therefore the son that she was given, Hagar was given, was a very active one. La'anot zera Abraham v'sara b'chol minei ha'inui. Who would give the descendants of Abraham and Sarah equal suffering in part in every imaginable way. In other words, Abraham and Sarah were punished gravely for the way that they handled this situation. Again, here we have Ramban, nobody more reverent in general of biblical figures, nobody more mainstream in terms of, it's hard to find anybody who had a greater contribution on all of Jewish history and Torah study than the Ramban. The Rambam, Rashi, these are the greatest of the greats. Okay, this isn't some exotic, outlying, you know, sectarian figure. This is the Ramban. And yet he's able to say, with great respect and with great reverence, but nonetheless he's able to say it's a terrible sin. Chata imenu bi'inoi hazeh. And Avram is also guilty, and we were punished for it.
But
yes?
It's like so much information. I don't know how else to start. But you said about the punishment of the descendants. Mm-hmm. That's like a heavy duty punishment.
That's very
like
serious.
Two people that oppress one person, and as a result, descendants. I mean, a lot of people.
But the interesting thing is that it came true. That's what's so interesting. That's what I was asking about the timeline, because that's what's happening.
This is amazing.
But I think what Justine is saying is really correct in the sense that the Ramban must be saying that this is a pretty grave sin, because it's something that for the Ramban warrants this kind of punishment. Isn't that interesting?
Hagar was powerless, I guess.
And I think it's an example.
Very well said. And then taking advantage of somebody who's powerless. Yeah, that's perfect. Okay, we're going to read the document. It's very good.
A lot of the situation for future generations.
That's true.
That also you act this way, and it's going to come back to you.
Right. But let me ask you're in power now.
Right.
But the situation that the tables will be turned, and later see how you like it when you're not in control. That's the idea. There's a mita connected.
When you're talking about the timeline, and you say all of a sudden a God appears on the horizon.
As far as the text is concerned,
right.
We don't have anything.
However, from a historical point.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the beginning of this story relate to when Abraham came back from Egypt?
Okay, so we know
10 years
after. So very good.
So it really fits into the whole theory.
Right, Abraham.
That she was related.
It has
to the king of Egypt.
1000%.
It wasn't like 20, 30 years later. This was right afterwards.
Right. The piece that she's related to the king is harder to justify because it could have been any Egyptian woman who they met down there. Right. They could have. Abraham was in Egypt for some time. He could have met any. But for sure, it makes sense to say that they met her in Egypt.
But the fact is, it was the custom of the time, even to present time, that people gave people as booty.
Oh, for sure.
I mean,
we just don't know.
It was a tribes conquered tribes and then sold off them as booty.
100%.
Ramban is the one who always believes that what happens to the evoked happens to future generations.
Right. So
in many of the famous expressions, like, you know, but
Right.
So it's not only this, it's this whole theory, basically.
Right, so the Ramban does see, the Ramban does have that historical view. I just really wanted to read the Radak here, because I think it really makes sense perfectly in terms of the powerless idea that you're raising. I think that's very much what the Radak says. The Radak takes a similar view to the Ramban, but I'll just put this out there in a second. He differs from the Ramban in one crucial way. So we'll read the Radak and we'll see if somebody picks up on where the Radak deviates from the Ramban. Okay? Vata'ana Sarai, Asta ima yoter midai v'abdaba b'farach. Sarah did too much to Hagar, and she did avodat perech. She made her work extremely hard. Anybody know where that is?
That's from the Mitzrayim.
Exactly.
Terrible.
So the Radak says, what the Mitzrim would later do to us, the avodat perech, is exactly how Sarah treated Hagar. Efshar, says the Radak, shehaita makeota umikalelet ota, that she would hit her and curse her. Really horrible treatment. Velo haita yechola lisbol ubarcha mipaneha. And Sarah couldn't handle it. Excuse me, Hagar couldn't handle it and ran away. It was too much. She couldn't deal with it anymore. Velo nahaga Sarah bazeh lemidat musar velo lemidas chasidus. Sarah did not behave ethically or piously. Lo musar, it wasn't ethical. Ki afal pisha Avraham mochel ma al kavodo, even though Avraham enabled her to do this by saying, okay, you know, even though Hagar is my wife, she's under your control. The Amar la asila hatov beinayich, haya ra'oy la limshochad yada lichvodo velo la'anota. Sarah should have recognized that in the end, this is still the wife of my husband. I can't just treat her like she's somebody, you know, off the street that has no relationship to our family. Velo midas chasitos, and it wasn't pious either. V'nefesh tova ki ein, this is exactly the idea that was raised, ki ein ru'uya li'adam la'asdot kol yecholto b'meshe tachat yado. People should not do all that is in their power to somebody who's subordinate to them. If somebody is powerless, if somebody is under your control, it's not the proper thing to do to abuse them just because you can get away with it. Remember that famous line from Schindler's List where Schindler is having, you remember that conversation that Schindler has with Amon Geth? Okay, you want to save a line where Amon Geth says to Schindler, the commandant says to Schindler, Oscar, you're powerful, I want to be like you. What does it mean to be powerful? And Schindler says, power is to forgive. Power is to have the opportunity to crush and to oppress and to do what you want, but not to do that. That's what power is. To shoot somebody, to hurt somebody, to kill somebody, that is not power. To pardon is the power. Of course, Amget then goes around shooting people. He doesn't really get the message. But anyway, that was the Radak. The Radak says, Ein ru'uya l'adam la'asot kol yechoto b'meshe tachat yado. The Amar HaChacham, and the wise man said, Ma'nave ha'mechila ve'es ha'yecholas. To forgive, to pardon, when one can hold accountable, that is the proper thing. Umasha asta Sarai lo hayato be'enei ha'el. What Sarah did was not accepted by Hashem for that matter either. As the Pasuk says, Kemosha amar hamalach el Hagar, ki shama Hashem el anyech. Hashem has heard your suffering. Hashem validates your suffering. It's not fair. Vehe shibla bracha tachas aniyah. And Hashem gave her a bracha, the bracha of a child, and of being the mother of a great nation for her suffering. Avram lo mana Sarai mila anosa. Avram did not prevent Sarai from oppressing Hagar. Afal pi shehaya ra be'enav, even though he disapproved of it, says the Radak, mishum shalom bayis. Because he was in a no-win situation. He knew that if he told Sarah off, Sarah, who was already furious with him, would get even more angry. In the interest of Shalom Bayis, Avram did not intercede on Hagar's behalf. Okay, so in what way is the Radak a little different than the Ramban?
No, he's teaching proper conduct.
Okay, so he definitely has this agenda of, and we're going to see that in a second. They're fairly equivalent with how they relate to Sarah, but where's the difference? Who's, I think the Radak, you could say, it's a little more charitable in how he understands the role of not Sarah, but Avraham, right? He says Avraham had the right idea. He was trying to further Shalom Bayis. He just didn't know how. He was in a no-win situation. If he stands up for Hagar, right? He's creating a lot of controversy with Sarah. If he doesn't say anything, so then he's on better terms with Sarah, but on worse terms with Hagar. So the Radak isn't saying that Avram did exactly the right thing, it's just saying, you know, Avram's intentions were good. It wasn't like Avraham wanted Hagar to be tortured, right? That's what he's saying. Apal pi shehaya ra be'einav mishum shalom bayis. So at least Avram had the right intentions.
But there's no shalom bayis to begin with.
Well, right. So Avram was stuck. Yeah, Arthur.
There's something inconsistent in part of the text here, where it says that, Sarah's actions did not find favor with the Lord.
Right.
Okay? Yet, at the end of the story, when she sends him out.
When Sarah sends Hagar away.
And Abraham seems to be upset. And Hashem says to Abraham,
right, listen to Sarah. But that might not be a contradiction in the sense that what the Lord disapproved of was torturing her. But maybe separating ways would have been an acceptable thing to do. Actually maybe what we can discuss next week if people are interested, right, setting her free. There are different ways to look at what happened in that story, but there's no question that that does need to be discussed. That's a very fair point. I just wanted to key in on this last line here of the Radak. He says, "V'chein ze hasipor nichtov b'Torah," even though this story, the Radak believes, is highly critical of Sarah. "V'chein ze hasipor nichtov b'Torah liknos adam imenu midos tovos ulaharfi karaos," to learn proper conduct, to learn what it means to behave well. In other words, that we need stories in the Torah that sometimes show us the way not to go, so we can learn from it. Right? So again, is Sarah a wonderful person? Yes. Is Sarah a matriarch? Yes. Is she a person that we can learn a lot of wonderful things? Yes. But we also can't whitewash the story, says the Radak, and claim that this is another story to her credit. In fact, this story is meant to teach us mitos tovos, but through a counterexample. I just wanted to present, finally, that this is the last thing we'll see. Not all of the Rishonim, not all of the great Perushim of the Middle Ages read this story this way. The Abravanel, for example, did not. And I think that puts into greater relief, even greater contrast, the fact that Radak and Ramban read it the way they did, because there were other options available to them. It's not like that was the only way they could have read the story, but the fact that they were willing to read the story in a way that was critical of Sarah, and for the Ramban, even critical of Abraham, suggests that, right, done respectfully and done reverently, criticism of our Avod and Imahod is legitimate. So what does the Abravanel say? Hine Sarah antad Hagar ad shebarcha mipaneha. Katav haramban, she Sarah chat'a bazeh v'gam Abraham she'nicha la'asos. That it was a sin on both Sarah and Abraham's part. V'ein hadavar came, but it's not true, says the Abravanel. Probably referring to Aristotle here, the way to correct a character flaw is to go in the exact opposite direction. Right? The golden mean, what the Rambam calls a Shvil Hazab. So if a person is very miserly, he should give a lot of tzedakah and hopefully he'll correct down to somewhere in the middle, where he is modest and he saves, he's not a terrible spender, but he's also generous. And if a person is so finding the middle path, everybody's familiar with the theory in general. Okay, kemoshe yikro them ashrei hamachlos hamuvato sheyasu osam letzadam nagid veopen shekasher yisharu betivam yamdu beemzer bematzua. Right, just like the Rambam and Aristotle, they both give the example, right, if a stick is crooked, then how do you get the stick to go to the middle? So you bend it all the way in the other direction, and then hopefully the stick will average out in the middle. V'chein Sarah. This is exactly what Sarah had in mind. Ka'asher ra'ata et Hagar b'ga'on u'b'ga'ava u'b'ga'on v'derech ra. When she saw that Hagar had become arrogant and conceited and haughty, because after all, Hagar was pregnant, and Sarah was not able to. And the Torah says, v'teikal gevirta b'eineha, that Hagar looked at Sarah differently. We don't know what exactly she did, but something enough for Sarah to notice. Anta Osa. Sarah oppressed her, v'nishtabda ba v'koshi yoser mimasha haisa regila, and she worked her harder than she normally would have. V'kolze l'tachlas tov. Sarah didn't do it with an ounce of malice or with an ounce of anger. It was all for a noble and good purpose. Kidei lahashiva al hamatsua. Right? To return her to the middle. What's the analogy? That Hagar has become arrogant, so you have to really give her a lot of criticism, a lot of muster, a lot of hard work, so that she'll come back to the middle, or else she'll just have proper amount of self-esteem. That Sarah was really doing this for Hagar's best interests. That's the Rav Noel's perspective. V'hi chiforas muser, because Hagar couldn't take it. Baracham mipaneh derech hamidbar. So Hagar ran away. But Sarah had the right intentions. So that's not what the Radak said, and it's not what the Ramban said. We have a very, very strong disagreement between our Meforshim, between the Rav Noel on the one hand, and the Radak and the Ramban on the other, about whether Sarah is guilty. And we had a dispute between the Radak and the Ramban, a much smaller dispute about what Avram's level of culpability was. According to the Ramban, he enabled it, right? He's equally guilty, and therefore his descendants are going to be oppressed by Ishmael's, by Hagar's.
How does Abarbanel interpret that Hashem heard her suffering?
Very good question. Noticeably, he doesn't deal with it, whereas the Ramban and Radak both made a reference to that. Ki shama Hashem el anyeich sounds a lot like Hashem is validating her suffering. That is an outstanding question. I think that's one of the great rayas. After all, it's one of the proofs that the Ramban and the Radak cited. Excellent point. Justine.
If I'm saying this correctly, yeah. By memory, Sarah, she's the one that laughed also.
She did.
And as I'm thinking about Sarah, you said Hagar, Sarah, Abraham. Sarah seemed to be a mean person. You know, she seemed to be, you know, this. I don't know. She had an attitude all the time. Okay. And she joked about everything. And okay. She didn't take anything seriously. Mm-hmm. And when you
but again, Hagar, again, and so that's a very important story. And you know what? Because of the interest that was, well, maybe next week we'll do one more about Sarah, because mm-hmm. I think Sarah's characters generated a lot of interest. I just wanted to say that. At the same time as you can say that, remember the Ramban also pointed out here that Sarah made a great act of self-sacrifice. She could have given Hagar to her husband as a pilegesh, but she elevated Hagar because she thought it was more dignified. So the way that I would like to, and with this we'll conclude, to portray Sarah is that she was too ambitious for her own good. She thought she can handle having Hagar as a co-wife, as somebody who was a full isha, because... And again, that was very ambitious, morally and ethically, because now Hagar was going to be her equal. And in truth, because Hagar then demeans her, whatever exactly Hagar did, whether she insulted her, Sarah really couldn't handle that. And Sarah responded very disproportionately and really went way too far in her treatment of Hagar. So, in a way, Sarah was not trying, she didn't start off with this diabolical process, she was even too ambitious. I think she wanted to do right by Hagar and by Abraham, and ended up, the exact opposite thing happened. Yes?
Well, Susan. You know, we're reading these stories now with, we know the whole